Judaism's founder, Joseph Smith, created controversy wherever he went. But one of the criticisms he constantly faced were about the men he kept as friends and close associates. Consider what C.J. Webb said of Joseph Smith in 1886, quote, "Joseph acquired knowledge very rapidly and learned with special facility all the tricks of the scoundrels who worked at his company. He learned by heart a number of Latin, Greek, and French commonplace phrases to use them in his speeches and sermons. Joseph kept a learned Jew in his house for a long time for the purpose of studying Hebrew with him. I taught him the first rules of English grammar, Kirtland, in 1834. He learned rapidly." Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners, from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
Early Mormon missionaries were very familiar with biblical prophecies of hunting and fishing for the souls of humankind. Later in the Utah period, Heber C. Kimball, by then a counselor in the First Presidency, would say, quote, "I will tell you it is hard work to deal with such a hard set of people. A more wicked set of scoundrels never lived than when we got here. Is it not too bad to be afflicted with such creatures? It is hard, but we have got to bear it, and we shall bear it, till the gospel net gathers of every kind of fish," end quote. Okay, so when he said every kind of fish, he meant it. Converts to Mormonism came from all sorts of backgrounds, some from organized religion like Methodists and Baptists, etc., many from more of these nebulous seeker movements, and some with very little experience of any religion at all and were there just for the ride.
Early Mormonism was like a big pot of soup. So you have normal elements of Western religion, normal in quotes, God, faith, prayer, the Bible, the resurrection, so on. But then at the same time, you've got these elements of folk religion that we've talked about, divining rods, amulets, superstitions, etc. Add to that things that, while they didn't solely belong to Mormons at the first, they eventually become identity markers. Visions of God and angels, health codes. We promise we'll talk about the word of wisdom here before too long. Missionary labors and these kind of things. Not to mention the Book of Mormon. The result? You get a fluid, often chaotic environment where boundaries and norms really hadn't fully developed yet. And at every juncture, with every new wrinkle that Joseph Smith introduces, there are people who essentially say, "Nope, I'm done, that's not me." Some were more overt about this, louder than others. These are your bad boys of early Mormonism.
Around this town like it's holy land. You got good looking friends, y'all sharp dressed men. Been getting big, making me look small. It don't matter to me, cause I'm a 10 feet and 10 feet tall.
Okay, first up on the bad boy countdown, drumroll please, it's Hiram Page. For those casually interested in Mormon history, you might know two things about him. He was one of the 8 witnesses to the Book of Mormon, and he had a seer stone. Like Joseph Smith and some early Mormons, he was born in Vermont. And we don't know much about his early life. He apparently was a doctor and traveled extensively. But as he moved around the East, he encountered various religious strains and seems to have become a seeker. You know, someone seeking for the divine, seeking for a greater purpose. Then in 1825, he turns up in New York and marries into the Whitmer family. Every Mormon knows that last name. Catherine Whitmer was the oldest daughter in a family of 7 children. Her only sister, Elizabeth Ann, later married Oliver Cowdery, another Mormon name. Though the Pages were clearly at the epicenter of Mormonism due to the Whitmer connection, sadly, they left no record of what happened and how they felt. 4 years and a child later, Catherine was then 4 months along with their second child. The Book of Mormon manuscript is now finished, and Joseph Smith selects three witnesses who signed a statement saying that an angel showed them the Book of Mormon plates. Almost as an afterthought, he also designates eight witnesses, including three Smiths, Joseph Sr., Hiram, and Samuel, four Whitmers, Christian, Jacob, Peter, and John, and a Whitmer-in-law, Hiram Page. This last group was apparently shown the plates by Joseph Smith. In their signed statement, they claimed that they had, quote, seen and hefted the plates. Then in early 1830, Hiram Page accompanied his brother-in-law, Oliver Cowdery, and two others to Canada to try and sell the copyright of the Book of Mormon. Random aside, the revelation that instructs them to go specifically cuts out Martin Harris. You know, the guy who basically funded the printing of the Book of Mormon. His name is blacked out big time in the text.
So far, you're probably thinking, wait a minute, there's nothing bad about this dude. You're not wrong. In this episode, bad is basically going to equal didn't agree with Joseph Smith rather than, say, hardened criminal. And that's the case here. CC, Hiram Page, was also a revelator. Hiram Page also had a seer stone. Quick tangent time here. So contemporary LDS people probably think of Joseph Smith as being president of the church, you know, the one guy in charge of everything. And that's only sort of true. While he had founded the church, things were a lot more democratized at this point. And, you know, it only later does it become really stratified where the president of the church is really absolutely in charge. Thank Brigham Young for that development. And you also have to remember that American culture right at this time really prizes an even playing field for people. As long as, you know, you were a dude, oh yeah, and also white. So, yeah, keep that in mind. And at this point, there's really not a church hierarchy. That will come later. And there's really not any precedent. So when challenges to Joseph Smith's authority cropped up, what does he do? He doesn't really have a model to go on. And there'd already been a conflict where Oliver Cowdery, Hiram Page's brother-in-law, suggested a change to one of Joseph Smith's revelations, and the rest of the Whitmer family sides with Cowdery. And by Joseph's telling of this, eventually everything is smoothed over and, quote, error rooted out. So you can clearly see that Joseph Smith feels this ownership of how the narrative needs to be told. So then, in September 1830, Joseph Smith and Emma will move back to New York, but when they arrive there, they discover that Hiram Page had been receiving revelations through his seer stone.
So Newell Knight, who was a key early Mormon figure, said that Page had, quote, quite a roll of papers full of these revelations, and many in the church were led astray by them, end quote. So this is interesting. A couple observers describe Page seeing words appearing on the stone, and then they would disappear once he had written them down. It's very Harry Potter. I like it. This sounds very similar to how several people described Joseph Smith using his seer stone during the Book of Mormon project. So again, if this is happening, what do you do if you're Joseph Smith? Remember at the time that Mormons are a very small group and total membership is about 60 people. To have the entire extended Whitmer family believing in Page's revelations is kind of a big deal. How do you parse out whose magic is right? Who is seeing from God? Who has the authority? And herein maybe enters the obsession with Mormon authority. So Joseph Smith fights revelation with revelation. In a document that later becomes DNC 28, the voice of the Lord gets after Oliver Cowdery, first saying, quote, "No one shall be appointed to receive commandments and revelations in this church excepting my servant Joseph, for he receiveth them as Moses, and thou shalt be obedient unto the things which I shall give unto him," end quote. So this is kind of a genius move. Rather than Joseph Smith having to confront Page directly, Cowdery has to get this resolved. He is told by God, quote, "Thou shalt take brother Hiram between him and thee alone, and tell him that those things which he has written from the stone are not of me, and that Satan deceiveth him, for behold, those things have not been appointed unto him. Neither shall they be appointed unto any of this church contrary to the church articles and covenants, for all things must be done in order," end quote. At a conference held right after this revelation, the very first item of business, Joseph Smith Jr. was appointed by the voice of the church conference to receive and write revelations and commandments for this church.
So Hiram Page's revelations, his seer stone, what happened to them?
I had a vision plain and true. Saw something that few people do. Lord God, I think I've seen enough.
According to Emer Harris, who is brother of Martin Harris, Page decided to destroy his stone. He falls in line, he demonstrates his loyalty to Joseph Smith. Quite the dramatic moment. And it seems like he destroyed his revelations also. Now, in retrospect, it's very surprising that Mark Hoffman, the forger, didn't quote-unquote discover them. This was just a golden opportunity. I hadn't really thought about it until we were thinking about this episode, but man, that would have been just such a natural for him to come up with Hiram Page's revelations. So for the next several years, Hiram and Catherine Page lived a pretty normal Mormon life. They move their family to Missouri, they get kicked out, they go north, you know, basically the same story of everyone else. But in later years, Hiram would identify this episode where they went to Canada to sell the copyright and then the loss of Mormon lands in Jackson County as two key points that really fueled his growing disaffection. I mean, like we said, they're at the epicenter of Mormon life. So Hiram and his Whitmer relatives would be the settlers of Far West in 1838. And even after Mormons leave, they continue to live there. And this final split between the Whitmer family and Joseph Smith's leadership seems to begin with some accusations regarding land transactions in Far West. So David Whitmer, remember Hiram Page's brother-in-law, was accused of profiting off of land sales to Mormons. So remember, Joseph Smith is in Kirtland, and so what he does is he designates leaders in Missouri on the ground there to kind of watch over things. And part of that was parceling out land to all these new people moving in. And so it seems, and it's really tough to nail it down, but people like David Whitmer and W.W. Phelps appear to have figured out that they could make some money off of this. And, I mean, you can understand it. They're church leaders. They're giving a lot of their time to these labors, and they need to feed their own families. So, I mean, you can see where it comes from. But then these claims also start to include things like the Whitmers were not following the church health code called the Word of Wisdom. And this should be interesting. I mean, it'll make sense once we do more with Word of Wisdom, but this is not a hard and fast thing at this point. So for somebody to be accused of not following the Word of Wisdom either means that it was pretty egregious or somebody is looking for an excuse to nail him. And so finally what happens is the Whitmer brothers and Oliver Cowdery, brother-in-law, were excommunicated. Now this is interesting because a lot of times it's just assumed that Hiram Page, he's part and parcel with the Whitmer family, he's also excommunicated. However, there's really no record of it. And his biographer, Bruce Stewart, pretty well comes down on that no church discipline is handed out to him. Nevertheless, he does join the family and they leave Mormonism there. So Hiram Page spends the rest of his life, very normal life, near Richmond, Missouri. And what's fun is his grave is just along the side of the road. So you're tooling down the road to go to this little city, and there's Hiram Page right along the side there. One interesting thing about his later life, he does continue to follow his family's very unique view of Mormon succession. So after Joseph Smith dies, Hiram Page wrote a letter to fellow bad boy, William McClellan, stay tuned, who Page actually followed for a short time. But in this letter, he supports his brother-in-law David Whitmer's claim to authority, but interestingly, not unless he was a true seer. Listen to this, quote, "He who has these things, i.e. a seer stone, is called a seer. If it requires the possession of these means to constitute a seer, then David cannot be said to be a seer at this time."
Since historian Christopher C. Smith has become a podcast favorite, let's hear who he thinks his favorite Mormon bad boy is.
My personal favorite Mormon bad boy, which is a phrase that I never thought I'd say, is Martin Harris, one of the three witnesses. Martin was born in Easttown, New York, and then moved to Palmyra in early 19th century, became a prosperous farmer there. And at age 26, he married his 9 years younger first cousin, Lucy Harris. If you've seen the South Park episode, you'll know her as Lucy Harris, smart, smart, smart. And if you're really confused right now, that's okay too. Harris developed a reputation in Palmyra for being an honest and hardworking farmer, a good person, but also a bit of a religious zealot. His neighbors called him a visionary fanatic, a great talker, and an extravagant boaster, and said that he saw angels and ghosts and devils and spooks. He once said that he'd seen Jesus Christ and that Jesus was the handsomest man he'd ever seen. He also said he'd seen the devil, who he described as a very sleek-haired fellow with 4 feet and a head like that of a jackass. And on another occasion, he said he met the Lord Jesus Christ, who walked along beside him in the shape of a deer for 2 or 3 miles, talking with him as familiarly as one man talks with another. So prone to visions, this Martin Harris. In 1870, he recalled that as early as 1818, the Lord told him not to join any particular church, for no churches had authority from the Lord. Now, that memory sounds a lot like the first vision, so it's fully possible that his memory has been changed, inflected through his later Mormonism. But on the other hand, Mormonism tended to attract precisely these kinds of people, people who believed in dreams and visions and who were suspicious of institutional churches. Those were exactly the type of people that Mormonism attracted. So this memory may be accurate. He may or may not have been a member of any church, but he certainly affiliated or hung around a lot of different religions. He was raised an Orthodox Quaker. Quakers were a pacifist group that didn't have ministers and believed in personal revelation. So this is undoubtedly where a lot of his sort of revelatory tendencies come from. Then, according to one of his neighbors, he became a Restorationer Universalist. And this is also the kind of Universalist that Joseph Smith Sr. was. Restorationers took the Bible's promise that God was going to restore all things to mean that all souls would be restored to heaven and therefore that everyone would be saved. So that's where they get their name, Restorationer, is the restoration of all things, of all souls. Neighbors also then remember Harris joining the Baptists, Methodists, and Presbyterians at various times before he joined the Mormons. So he's what we call a seeker, the kind of person who was always grabbing on to the next religion that came along, never fully satisfied with any of them, holding out for something to come along that will really satisfy his religious urges and his religious needs. In one of the very first interactions between Joseph Smith and Martin Harris, they meet in the street. And Joseph reportedly told Martin Harris that he'd had a revelation that Harris would give him $50 to help translate the Book of Mormon. In one version, Joseph Smith says, "I have had a vision that the first honest man I meet will give me $50, and Harris hands over the money. Whatever the exact words that Joseph Smith used, Harris did give him the money, and Joseph then went on to receive more revelations for Harris, designating him as a scribe for the Book of Mormon translation, as one of the three witnesses of the golden plates, and commanding him to mortgage his farm for $3,000 to pay the printer for the publication of the Book of Mormon, which Harris did. Now, Harris was a true believer in the Book of Mormon, but he also saw himself as an investor. Joseph Smith set an initial retail price for the Book of Mormon that would have quadrupled Harris's investment. So when Harris's wife, Lucy, told him that he was being scammed, he replied, "So what if it is a lie? If you let me alone, I will make money at it." So he's planning on getting rich off the Book of Mormon, in addition to being a believer in its religious message. Apparently, within the Harris home, the Book of Mormon became such a contentious issue, with Lucy being a non-believer in it and Martin being a believer in it, that he actually beat her on occasions. And that may have been after he brought home a portion of the Book of Mormon manuscript to show to her, and then the manuscript disappeared, probably because she burned it. So this was something that really divided their home. When Martin lost that portion of the Book of Mormon manuscript, that began his falling out with Joseph Smith. So according to Joseph Smith's official history, Harris badgered him about borrowing the manuscript, and Smith refused him twice. But finally, Harris broke him down, and Smith agreed to let him take it on condition that he would swear to only show it to a few specific people. And according to Smith, Harris broke this oath and showed the manuscript to everybody who came along. And then after the manuscript goes missing, Joseph dictates Doctrine and Covenants Section 3, a revelation that chastises both Smith and Harris for transgressing the commandments that had been given to them. Harris for breaking his oath, and Smith for badgering the Lord for permission to give the manuscript over to Harris. So later, then, Smith receives another revelation about the same thing, D&C 10, which is even harsher toward Martin Harris. The revelation basically says the loss of the manuscript wasn't an accident at all. It was a sinister plot by Martin Harris to destroy Joseph. Joseph is told that because you delivered up those writings into the hands of a wicked man, meaning Martin Harris, you've lost them. Behold, they have sought to destroy you. Yea, even the man in whom you have trusted has sought to destroy you. And for this cause, I said that he is a wicked man, for he has sought to take away the things wherewith you have been entrusted, and he has sought to destroy your gift. So Martin Harris here is accused not only of being a wicked man, but of seeking to destroy Joseph Smith. And the revelation goes on to explain the nature of the plot. Wicked men have taken the manuscript and they've altered it so that if Joseph translates the same material over again, the new manuscript won't agree with the altered original. So the idea is these people have taken the manuscript, they've changed it, and then if Joseph Smith translates the same material over again in the exact same words, these people are going to take the altered manuscript, the altered original, and they're going to say, oh, look, it doesn't agree with the new translation, and therefore Joseph Smith has contradicted himself and he's not a true prophet. So in order to prevent this issue, Joseph is commanded to translate from a different portion of the plates that tells an abridged version of the same basic story, and thus the designs of the wicked men are frustrated. Now, Martin almost certainly laid no such plot. Like I said, this guy was a true believer, and he remained loyal to Joseph Smith despite these denunciations. He knew that he'd screwed up, and he took this chastisement in stride. And this is where South Park, for believing this story that Joseph Smith tells about wicked men having designs to alter the manuscript, South Park represents him as Dumb Dumb Dumb, and his wife is Smart Smart Smart. You should really check out the episode. It's pretty funny if you haven't seen it. After the loss of the manuscript, Oliver Cowdery became Joseph Smith's primary scribe, and Martin sort of fades into the background. But he still had an important role to play as one of the three witnesses of the Book of Mormon plates. And this is, of course, what he's most famous for, is his role as a witness. So according to Joseph Smith's account of this, Smith took Harris, David Whitmer, and Oliver Cowdery to the woods in mid-1829. And they prayed to see the plates. And they prayed for a while without success, whereupon Martin, feeling unworthy, excuses himself from the group and goes off to pray alone. He thought that maybe his presence was what was stopping them from having a vision. Soon after he left, Whitmer and Cowdery had a vision, and then Smith went and found Martin and prayed with him until he had a vision too. And after this, Martin testifies very fervently of the plates, which I'm sure went a long way to repairing things between him and Joseph. Martin, by the way, tells a slightly different version of this story. He said that it was the other people who accused him of being the reason that they hadn't seen a vision yet. And so they sort of pushed him out of the group. And it was 3 days later that he finally saw a vision of the plates. But anyway, whatever the details of this story, Martin eventually has a vision and he testifies of the plates. But then Martin admitted to some neighbors that he'd seen the plates with his spiritual eyes, not with his physical eyes. He tells the printer, among other people, that he's seen them in vision, he's seen them spiritually. And in saying this, he directly violated a revelation that Joseph had received a couple months earlier, which instructed the witnesses exactly what they were allowed to say about the experience and what they weren't. They were commanded to say, "Behold, I have seen the things, and I know of a surety that they are true, for they have been shown unto me by the power of God." And they were explicitly commanded to say no more than that, and never to deny the experience lest they be condemned. So by admitting that this was a spiritual vision and not a physical experience, Martin was actually violating this revelation that Joseph Smith had given to try to sort of shape what the witnesses were allowed to say. And so by the 1830, the Smiths are fed up with Martin. They're done with him. And as punishment for his transgressions, they want to cut him completely out of the proceeds from the sales of the Book of Mormon. According to David Whitmer, Hiram Smith was vexed with Brother Martin and thought they should get the money by some means outside of him and not let him have anything to do with the publication of the book or receiving any of the profits thereof if profits should accrue. So Martin now is getting worried that he might not get his money back. And so he retaliates by threatening to stop paying the printer. And so there's some negotiation in January 1830 between Joseph and Martin, and they finally sign a contract which allows Martin the privilege to sell the Book of Mormon until he's recouped his $3,000 investment, but not any profit above and beyond that. So he can sell the Book of Mormon until he gets his money back, but he's not entitled to any of the profits. And then in 1830, Joseph receives a revelation that sends several men to Canada to sell the Canadian copyright of the Book of Mormon in Canada, which he expects to get $8,000 for. And part of the purpose of the trip may have actually been to get alternate funding for paying the printer so that they could no longer be dependent on Martin, so that they could get rid of him entirely. And the Revelation promises the men who go to Canada that they're going to share in the profits of the sale, which the Revelation calls temporal blessings. But it excludes Martin Harris from that. So it says they're going to share in the temporal blessings with the exception of Martin Harris. And Hiram Page actually says that the preparation for the journey was made in a sly manner, meaning that it was kept secret so as to keep Martin Harris from drawing a share of the money. They were worried that as an investor in the book, he would claim to have a rightful share and that he might even take them to court over this. So they figured, let's just keep it secret so that he doesn't even know that it's happening. Now, of course, the mission to sell the Canadian copyright fails, and so how to split the proceeds becomes a non-issue. Martin apparently continued to have reservations about funding the project because in March 1830, Joseph receives another revelation for him, which says it encourages him to stay the course. And it says, I command you that thou shalt not covet thine own property. Thou shalt not covet thine own property. That's one of my favorite lines in the whole revelation. I just think that's brilliant. Thou shalt not covet thine own property, but impart it freely to the printing of the Book of Mormon, which contains the truth and the word of God. Great shall be your blessing, yea, even more than if you should obtain treasures of the earth and corruptibleness to the extent thereof. Behold, canst thou read this without rejoicing and lifting up thy heart for gladness? Somehow I doubt that being commanded to pay a bunch of money caused Martin great rejoicing and lifting up his heart for gladness, but there it is. He did pony up the money, as the revelation commanded him to do. And he literally lost the farm. The farm got foreclosed and sold in order to pay the printer. And he also lost his wife. Martin and Lucy Harris separated over all of this, effectively ending their marriage, although they didn't formally divorce. And it's kind of interesting that in 1831, Joseph received a revelation that allowed Martin the privilege of taking a wife from among the Lamanites. The idea seems to be that Martin's first marriage was effectively over and therefore didn't count anymore, and he was free to take another wife. But some historians have suggested that this is Joseph Smith's first flirtation with polygamy, because if Martin had acted on this revelation, he'd have been legally married to two women at once. And so maybe Joseph Smith had polygamy in the back of his mind already in 1831. Hard to say. Next time Martin gets in trouble with Joseph is in 1834. And this is when Sidney Rigdon brings charges against him before a council of high priests for saying that Joseph Smith drank too much liquor while translating the Book of Mormon, and also for exalting himself above Joseph Smith, claiming that Joseph didn't know the contents of the Book of Mormon until it was translated, but Martin had known all of it in advance. He'd known what the Book of Mormon was going to say before Joseph Smith even translated it. Now remember, Martin's a grandiose person. He likes to boast about visions, so this is totally in character for him. Anyway, he humbly repents. He's regarding the liquor claim. He says, oh, I didn't mean to say that Joseph Smith drank liquor while translating the Book of Mormon. I meant to say that he drank too much liquor before translating the Book of Mormon, which is kind of a dubious retraction. But anyway, he repents and the council sort of lets him off with a slap on the wrist. And he remains then a good member in a member in good standing until 1837. At which point he joins other dissenters in Kirtland and declares that Joseph Smith has become a wretch and he's excommunicated over this. And his reasons for joining the dissenters were that Joseph Smith had gotten caught having sex with a servant girl in his house, Fanny Alger, and Martin regarded this as an affair and as adultery, although some claim that it was Joseph Smith's first plural marriage. And also, Joseph Smith had started a bank and prophesied that the bank was going to basically take over the world, it was going to be hugely successful, and then the bank failed, and a lot of Mormons in Kirtland lost their money. And Harris regarded the bank as a swindle. That's the word that he used. So after his excommunication, then, Martin seems to have gone through sort of the entire gamut of reactions that somebody could possibly have. According to Stephen Burnett, another Mormon, in 1838, Martin talked at a public meeting and said that he had never seen the plates with his natural eyes, only in vision or imagination. He said he had hefted the plates repeatedly in a box with only a tablecloth or a handkerchief over them, but he never saw them except as you see a city through a mountain. So this makes Martin arguably the only one of the three witnesses to actually deny his experience of having seen the plates, if what Burnett says is accurate. Now, Burnett may not be fully reporting what Martin said. Burnett also claims that Martin said that the eight witnesses, there's statements of three witnesses and statement of eight witnesses at the beginning of the Book of Mormon, both of which claim that they saw the golden plates. But Martin says that the eight witnesses never saw the plates, and they hesitated to sign the testimony of eight witnesses for that reason, but they were persuaded to do it, which is a pretty shocking allegation. So again, hard to say whether this account by Stephen Burnett is accurate. Martin Harris later denies it, but several apostles are supposed to have apostatized from the LDS Church over these statements by Martin Harris. Now, Martin Harris does say he still believes in the Book of Mormon, but he believes that Joseph Smith has become worldly and proud and a knave and imposter. Now, Harris seems to have been rebaptized twice, actually, in 1840 and again in 1842. But it didn't stick either time. And by 1843, he joins a movement called the Shakers. Shakers were a prophetic movement, much like the Mormons, but led by a prophetess named Mother Ann Lee. And they have very similar kinds of enthusiastic experiences. And they were kind of revivalistic, lots of visions and prophecies and spirits speaking through people. They have lots of miracles. There's something called the era of manifestations. And they had similar kinds of practices of bearing your testimony of Shakerism. And in 1844, Martin Harris goes to Nauvoo as a Shaker missionary, and he testifies that his testimony of Shakerism is greater than it ever was of the Book of Mormon. His Shaker affiliation, though, doesn't stick either, and he seems to have left them by about 1845. Now, after Joseph Smith's death, a succession crisis splits the LDS Church. Brigham Young leads the largest group of Mormons to Utah, but there are also several other contenders for the prophetic office of the LDS Church. And Martin goes through a bunch of these. He first joins James J. Strang, and in 1846, he actually serves a mission to England to proselytize people to Strangitism. James Strang was kind of the most interesting of the successors to Joseph Smith. He does things like practice animal sacrifice, and he digs up his own set of golden plates, which he carries around in his pocket and shows to people. Quite a colorful character. Martin doesn't last long as a Strangite, though. By 1847, he joins David Whitmer, who another of the three witnesses who set himself up as kind of an alternative successor to Brigham Young. In 1851, he joins Gladden Bishop. And then in 1855, he joins Joseph Smith's brother, William Smith, who has set himself up as the true prophet and successor. Now, during these years, Martin adamantly denied ever having said anything about seeing the plates with his spiritual eyes. His testimony becomes increasingly concrete. And instead, he told people that he'd held the plates on his knee for an hour and a half and handled plate after plate. And he holds up his hand and says, "Do you see that hand? Are you sure you see it? Or are your eyes playing a trick on you or something? No? Well, as sure as you see my hand, so sure did I see the angel in the plates." So really concrete language about his testimony of the Book of Mormon. And at the same time that he's testifying of the Book of Mormon, he's also denouncing Joseph Smith and Brigham Young. He calls them Latter-day devils, and he says that they waited until they'd taken all of his property, and then they threw him out of the church. So he's testifying of the Book of Mormon, but very much opposed to particularly the Utah branch of the Latter-day Saints. But in his old age, Martin changes his tune about the Utah church. And very famously, in 1870, he moves to Utah, and he's rebaptized into the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And Utah Mormons love to celebrate this fact. They love to talk about how on his deathbed, Martin Harris testified of the Book of Mormon, and he died a faithful member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. What they're not telling you is that in 1875, this guy named Anthony Metcalf visits Martin Harris, and Martin tells him that Joseph Smith had been a fallen prophet when he died, and that Martin's only motivation in coming to Utah was to see what was going on there. And Martin also told Metcalf that he regarded himself as the one mighty and strong. And this is a figure in the Doctrine and Covenants who's supposed to set in order the house of God. And Harris refers to his own marred visage and uses this as evidence that he's the suffering servant of Isaiah and that he's going to lead the saints to Zion. Martin's an old man. How he thinks he's going to be the one mighty and strong when he's practically on his deathbed, I don't know. But anyway, he seems to have come to Utah basically with the intention of sort of investigating the possibility of setting himself up as a great reformer of the Utah church. And so there's no question that Martin Harris died a believer in the Book of Mormon, but he also seems to have died a believer that God had rejected the LDS church and that he had a mission to reform it and to set it straight.
You know this next bad boy, the second elder of Mormonism himself, Brother Oliver Cowdery. He was born in Vermont. The state website should list Mormon leaders as one of their principal exports. Oliver lived a really rough childhood. His mother died of consumption right before his third birthday. Are you ready to believe us that consumption was a big deal? Because I think we've talked about it in every single episode. Oliver's father quickly remarried, but it seems like Oliver spent the next few years living with an aunt and an uncle. Until they died of typhoid fever. The hits just keep on coming. And if that sounds familiar, it should. This is probably the same outbreak of disease that hit the Joseph Smith family. Let's talk about two events with Cowdery that are really important. First, the so-called, quote, wood scrape. You may remember a couple episodes back in this podcast when Chris Smith talked about this group. Nathaniel Wood was an excommunicated Congregationalist minister who began his own group known as Modern Israelites or New Israelites. Over time, they were associated with various practices such as polygamy and possibly even counterfeiting. A man named by Winchell, likely Justice Winchell, joined the group and introduced divining rods, which we've talked about in previous episodes as well. They became increasingly apocalyptic and predicted January 14th, 1802 as the day that the final destruction would begin. I don't ever get why anyone names an exact date, do you?
If you need a tip on how to identify somebody you should run away from, anytime you're getting month, day, and year for when anything is going to happen, it's a good sign to run away because it never works out.
Listen, I admire the confidence that it takes to give a date and just go for it. But usually what has happened and what I would say up until this point in history has happened is every revelation that has come, they'd been given a date and surprise, surprise, we're not here yet. And then, you know, usually you blame it on one of your followers. Somebody wasn't righteous enough. So people gathered around Winchell with their divining rods and Nathaniel Wood for this final destruction, and a militia had to be called in. They were run out of town, and that was most likely the end of their group. But there is a possibility that the Wood group was associated with two key people, Joseph Smith Sr. and William Cowdery, the father of Oliver Cowdery. The Smith connection is less likely, but the Cowdery connection is stronger, but still not solid. This is interesting given all the activities the Wood group was involved in, and at the very least, it should show you that the Smiths were not unique in this sort of like gathering, translating, divining rods, end of days sort of stuff. Another possibility is Cowdery in a book called View of the Hebrews. This book was written by a Congregationalist minister named Ethan Smith. The Cowdery family attended a congregation in Vermont that Ethan Smith presided over, but it's not certain if the family was still there when he was a minister. The book is important because some, including B.H. Roberts, General Authority in the LDS First Council 70, identify it as a source that Joseph Smith drew on to create the Book of Mormon. So stay tuned for more on this.
So as a 22-year-old, Oliver Cowdery comes to New York. He's a school teacher in the Smith neighborhood, and he actually stays with the family for a while. And while he's staying there, I mean, he's heard stories, and so you can imagine he's like, so your son, he's a prophet, right? They start telling him about his work and tell him that he's down in Pennsylvania right now translating the Book of Mormon. Oliver gets on his horse, rides out of town, and when he arrives in Pennsylvania, things really get moving. You know, you've had the Lost Pages episode, and it's hard to keep a consistent scribe and all this, but once Cowdery's on the scene, things get going, and the book is published just about a year later. Then in 1830, when the church is formally organized, Oliver is designated the second elder. And this is such a great term because it gets reused by all sorts of different groups under the Mormon umbrella. This idea of second elder and designating your successor is really popular with fundamentalist Mormons, actually. And there's some big controversies on that. So, yeah, we will definitely hit that idea some more. So Oliver, you can imagine his mindset, you're designated the second elder, you can see how he would have a sense of ownership on how things go. And if you remember back a little bit when we were talking about Hiram Page, we mentioned that Joseph Smith had to deal with Oliver challenging his authority at one point. So let's revisit that. So this is the summer of 1829, and Oliver drafts a document that he envisioned as kind of like the Constitution or, quote, Articles of the Church of Christ. And it really was not something that he took lightly. He prefaced the text of the Articles with, quote, a commandment from God unto Oliver how he should build up his church and the manner thereof. So Oliver really sees like this is just as much his responsibility as Joseph's, right? He's the second elder. Now, about this same time, Joseph Smith is creating a similar document called, quote, the Articles and Covenants of the Church of Christ. And some historians have kind of seen Smith's text as a revision or expansion of Cowdery's document. However, historian Scott Follering disagrees and calls this conclusion, quote, both inaccurate and misleading. Instead, he argues that we need to see these as independent projects, but with similar goals. So when Oliver Cowdery reads Joseph Smith's documents, he sent him a letter, quote, commanding Joseph Smith to change part of the text. Joseph Smith doesn't get commanded by anyone, unless, you know, it's Jesus in a revelation. The Smith document indicated that candidates for baptism must, quote, truly manifest by their works that they have received the gift of Christ unto the remission of their sins, close quote. But Oliver felt like this section smelled like priestcraft. We don't have to demonstrate by works. That's nonsense. And from Oliver's perspective, his approach to how to deal with this would seem very natural. You know, he's the second elder. He gets to help decide how things go. Even LDS historian Joseph Fielding Smith described the relationship between Smith and Cowdery thusly, quote, Oliver Cowdery's standing in the beginning was as the second elder of the church, holding the keys jointly with the prophet Joseph Smith, close quote. Also, Oliver is better educated than Joseph Smith, and you can totally see how he feels perfectly authorized to modify things. Joseph? No dice, he's not having it. Oliver, commanding him to change something, really stuck in his craw big time. Joseph himself noted that it was, quote, not without both labor and perseverance, close quote, that he talked Cowdery and the rest of the Whitmers down off the ledge. I would love to know what Oliver really felt, though, because clearly he agreed to go along with Joseph Smith, but he's not, you know, it's not like he totally agrees with Joseph Smith on this point.
Okay, I just want to take an aside, though, because Brian and I had a really interesting weekend this last weekend. He came with Sunstone as we did a conference in Short Creek. And I have to say that this whole talk about people having revelations and competing revelations, sometimes you think, like, how did they have time to do this? Like, they sat there and they talked religion. But that community is a perfect example. You can go down there, and the folks that are really committed to religious thinking, magical thinking, religion and orthodoxy in general are all having similar conversations.
And as much as some people really dislike the idea of hierarchy and structure, if you don't organize it, it'll just kind of create itself. And we saw this firsthand. When you don't have a viable, expressed candidate for leadership, they will crop up. And then things get messy.
Yeah, we're specifically talking about the fact that we were down there and we got to talk to a new person who believes that they're the new prophet, you know, because there's a lot of chaos in that community right now and they've lost their leadership and no one knows who's in charge, but they're left with all this religious idea fervor and sort of this, this is what importance looks like, you know, to form a church and to have authority. And so there are a bunch of contenders right now happening in some of the communities and we got to witness that. And, you know, when we were talking to this man who believes he's a prophet, Brian looked at me and said, oh, this is just like early Mormonism right here. Power vacuum, chaos, and a lot of people focused on religion. But back to Oliver Cowdery. So Oliver Cowdery commanding Joseph Smith was pretty much strike one against him, but not a deal breaker. And he somehow remains Joseph's right-hand man. That is until Sidney Rigdon comes to town. From Oliver and David Whitmer's perspective, Rigdon sort of waltzes in and steals all their thunder. They had been there from the beginning, but this Johnny-come-lately, relatively speaking, is now Joseph's new guy. However, Oliver is still really important. He helps with various printing projects, from newspapers to scriptures like the Book of Commandments, Doctrine and Covenants, and the second edition of the Book of Mormon. But there's now a rift. During this period, there's a possibility that Oliver had an unauthorized plural wife. Mike Quinn identifies her as Mary Ann Lyman. And there are several later statements by George A. Smith and Brigham Young that Cowdery heard about early polygamy from Joseph Smith, but there's no obvious evidence to support either claim, so we'll put a question mark by it. It's interesting to note that when Cowdery is given a patriarchal blessing in 1833, it says, quote, "Blessed of the Lord is Brother Oliver. Nevertheless, there are two evils in him that he must needs forsake, or he cannot altogether escape the buffetings of the adversary." Again, question marks by the whole thing, but still interesting. What could the two things be together? Could they be pride and polygamy, or pride and gambling? Who knows?
Oliver would refuse to use the full name of the church, and that was bad news. So by the late 1830s, Oliver Cowdery is slowly, gradually falling out of the spotlight and favor. And like his Whitmer brothers-in-law, he's developing some dissent, because there are certain things that Joseph Smith is doing that during the late Kirtland, the Missouri period, that he just doesn't like. So finally, a church court is held in April 1838, and they explore 9 charges against Oliver. And they're so fascinating, I want to read you all of them. First, for stirring up the enemy to persecute the brethren by urging on vexatious lawsuits and thus distressing the innocent.
So the first charge is that he stirred up the enemy urging vexatious lawsuits. So they're accusing him of being litigative.
He's a lawyer. And Joseph Smith has been involved in a few court cases by this point. Not a lot. Obviously, once you hit Nauvoo, it goes nuts. But he's already got a distrust of lawyers. And Brigham Young will fall in his footsteps. So Oliver Cowdery being a lawyer, not a good mark in his book. Second, for seeking to destroy the character of President Joseph Smith Jr. by falsely insinuating that he was guilty of adultery.
Wait a minute. So adultery, can we elaborate on that? Do we know any specific women he was linked to?
So if you remember, Cowdery had been accused of having this unauthorized plural wife. He doesn't get this idea from nowhere. If you know anything about the kind of shadowy early years of polygamy, you might have heard Joseph Smith's alleged first plural wife is a woman named Fanny Alger. Not a well-kept secret. It was kind of, it seems everyone knew about it, including Oliver. And he will not keep quiet about this. In fact, we'll return to that. But
Joseph fights back and accuses him of accusing him of adultery.
Yeah. Accusing Joseph Smith at any point during Mormon history usually didn't end well. Wasn't as bad as Brigham Young would be about it, but yeah, Joseph, he didn't take criticism well, that's for sure. Third charge, for treating the church with contempt by not attending meetings. I like that one.
I feel like we've all been accused of that at some point. You know, you got that one busybody in your ward that's like, where were you last Sunday? Were you boating? Yeah, and this is just an early version of that.
It was funny. When we were down in Short Creek, somebody was asking, we toured the big meeting house there, and somebody asked about if there was assigned seating. And somebody said, no, but yes. As traditions go, everyone kind of creates their own assigned seating, which is nice. But then if you're not there, you can just look around and be like, oh, that guy's not there. That guy's not there. They must be voting. Fourth charge, for virtually denying the faith by declaring he would not be governed by any ecclesiastical authority nor revelation whatever in his temporal affairs. This is going to be a big one. We're going to do an episode at some point on the Kirtland Safety Society, which is Joseph's big experiment with finances. Spoiler alert, doesn't go well. Fifth, for selling his lands in Jackson County contrary to the revelations. See, this one is so interesting because they believe that this land is theirs and they're, you know, given to them by God. And so therefore, if you sell it, you're an apostate. So this is a big claim. Sixth charge, for writing and sending an insulting letter to President Thomas B. Marsh while on the High Council, attending to the duties of his office as president of the council, and by insulting the whole council with the contents of said letter. So picture everyone, all men at this time with a white glove in hand, ready to start a duel. This culture of honor is huge. You can't understand all the personality conflicts without understanding culture of honor. Big thing. Seventh charge, for leaving the calling in which God had appointed him by revelation for the sake of filthy lucre and turning to the practice of law. Here we go. Prejudice against lawyers. John Dinger somewhere is like, hey man, this isn't fair. Eighth charge, for disgracing the church by lying, being connected in the bogus business, as common report says. Remember when we talked about the Wood Group there was allegations that they had been involved in counterfeiting or making bogus, which bogus is way better than counterfeiting. And this is a charge that will follow Mormons for a long time. The Nauvoo years, particularly, very good evidence. In fact, there are federal indictments against Mormon leaders, including Brigham Young, for counterfeiting. So we'll definitely return to that. Ninth charge and final charge, for dishonestly retaining notes after they had been paid, and finally for leaving or forsaking the cause of God and betaking himself to the beggarly elements of the world and neglecting his high and holy calling contrary to his profession.
So that's quite the laundry list of charges, right? But I want to go back to number two, because I know if there are any women like me out there who are obsessed with polygamy, we just sort of glazed over the whole Fanny Alger thing. A few months before this particular trial where he gets all these allegations, Oliver wrote a very infamous letter to his brother Warren. In it, he reported a conversation with Joseph Smith in which, quote, a dirty, nasty, filthy affair of his and Fanny Alger's was talked over, in which I strictly declared that I had never deserted from the truth in the matter, end quote. Don't fret your gizzard. We will talk more about Fanny Alger, the first alleged plural wife of Joseph Smith. Cowdery chose not to attend this trial, but to send a somewhat snarky letter. Seriously, it's an entertaining read if you want to read it. He concluded, quote, this attempt to control me in my temporal interests, I conceive to be a disposition to take me from a portion of my constitutional privileges and inherent rights. I only respectfully ask leave, therefore, to withdraw from a society assuming they have such right. And that was the end of the second elder.
Since we haven't talked about Mark Hoffman the Forger in at least 5 minutes, let's do it again. His last great discovery, and by now you should realize that any time I talk about Mark Hoffman discovering something, there are air quotes. So this last discovery was going to be the fabled William McClellan collection. So what Hoffman was doing was taking money from investors and then paying off earlier people. Great pyramid scheme here. All the while promising this amazing cache of documents. So much material it would take a couple orange crates to hold it all. It's very great imagery. So who is this McClellan, and why would anyone care about documents that were associated with him? William Earl McClellan was born in Tennessee. So for once we get somebody not born in Vermont. Good for him. He was apparently raised by his father alone after the death of his mother. So just kind of a society comment here. You may have noticed how often these people that we're talking about were lost one or both of their parents. So in a culture where mortality rates are higher, diseases are not well understood, sanitation is not well understood, the chances of losing parents were quite high. Interesting thing we talked about also down at Short Creek was the impact that events from early childhood will have on health and, you know, both physical and mental later in life. And so the Mormon movement tends to, I mean, it's not, it would happen everywhere, but, you know, just because of mortality rates, you have a lot of people with this tumultuous childhood, losing parents, they get raised by relatives. I mean, Orson and Parley Pratt, same thing. So it happened to a lot of them. He grows up, McClellan, he becomes a school teacher, and moves around a lot. He would later brag that he had taught school in five different states. By 1829, he's now married and living in Illinois. But sadly, his wife, Cynthia Ann, died while giving birth to their first child. Again, not an uncommon experience, sadly. So he stays in Illinois. And while he's there, his town was kind of like this way station for missionaries that were coming through on the way to Missouri. And so he hears of the Mormon movement. And one of the elders happens to be David Whitmer, and he would have a profound influence on McClellan. And he's interested enough that he packs up and heads off to Jackson County and is baptized there.
As per the routine, he was ordained an elder 4 days later and sent off on a mission. He makes his way to Ohio, stopping in Illinois to visit his wife's grave. And once in Ohio, he met Joseph Smith and had the experience of being his scribe as William dictated a revelation about himself. For the most part, it's a fairly standard person-specific revelation, like, the gospel is awesome, go preach it, be good, knock and it shall be opened unto you, etc. However, one sentence is pretty noteworthy. Quote, commit not adultery, a temptation with which thou hast been troubled, end quote. Oh dear, this was obviously a problem with early Mormons. All things considered, though, so far so good. So starting the following year, William would be competing with W.W. Phelps for the title of Most Excommunicated, which I'm pretty sure could be Tyler Glenn's second album. His first apparent run-in came at the November 1831 conference. The main business under consideration was whether or not to print a collection of Joseph Smith's revelations. If you remember back a couple episodes, this is the origin of the Book of Commandments. Apparently, there were a few of the elders who were sure the revelations were polished enough to go out to the public. As a result, Joseph Smith dictates a revelation on the spot, which encourages anyone to try and come up with something better. And if not, then they have to sign a statement saying they acknowledge the divinity of the revelation. That's a good game there. I like it. Joseph Smith's later history describes William McClellan trying to do this and utterly failing. It's like the who shall ever pull the sword from the stone moment, right? But who can write a better revelation? What do you call that when you have like a revelation off?
Who's got the biggest quill, I guess.
This is kind of awesome. So here is the report of William McClellan failing this challenge. Quote, William E. McClellan, as the wisest man in his own estimation, having more learning than sense, endeavored to write a commandment like unto one of the least of the Lord's, but failed. It was an awful responsibility to write in the name of the Lord. The elders and all present that witnessed this vain attempt of a man to imitate the language of Jesus Christ, end quote. And this is great because it's like, yeah, William McClellan's really smart, but he's not as smart as God is. But I'd inject some caution here, though. The contemporary minutes don't mention this incident at all, and McClellan had left the church by the time this history was written. So even though it appears in our history, doesn't necessarily mean that we can back it up.
Wah, wah, wah. William McClellan can't write Revelation. Too bad for him. But after the conference, it must be mission time again. So this time, he's assigned to Joseph Smith's younger brother, Samuel. Once again, doesn't last long, and Samuel accuses McClellan of some vague improprieties. So maybe watch out for adultery comes back to get him. His call is revoked, and then a revelation tells him to shape up and then try another mission. So say what you will about early Mormonism, but you got lots of chances. Once again, it's a disaster. McClellan doubts his call came from God, and he bails on preaching the word and goes to work in a store instead. And so you can imagine by this point, nobody wants to be assigned William McClellan as missionary companions. Eventually, he gets back to Ohio and remarries, this time to a woman named Emmeline Miller. So Joseph Smith hears about bailing on the mission, working in the store, and getting married, and he's not happy. So he writes a letter to Emma, quote, I am not pleased to hear that William McClellan has come back and disobeyed the voice of him who is altogether lovely for a woman. I like this. Jesus is better looking than your wife. Really a weird line. I am astonished at Sister Emmeline, yet I cannot believe she is not a worthy sister. I hope she will find him true and kind to her, but have no reason to expect it. His conduct merits the disapprobation of every true follower of Christ. The moral of the story is that William definitely should have locked his heart. If he would just listen to the intro to this podcast every week, he would have learned his lesson, but no. So the McClellans join the group traveling from Ohio to Missouri, and Joseph gets all bent out of shape about William's behavior during the trip. And I would read what he said about it, but seriously, it doesn't even make sense. It really seems to be leftover angriness about William not locking his heart, coming back, getting married instead of being a missionary. So this kind of anger and resentment towards McClellan builds for several months until December 1832, High Council in Kirtland excommunicates him. What's so great and ironic is that very same day, McClellan, 700 miles away down in Missouri, is meeting with the High Council that day, not realizing he is being excommunicated. They needed email.
Speaking of excommunication, modern LDS folks think of excommunication in sort of bleak, permanent terms, but you got to remember that at this point in Mormon history, it's more like the penalty box in a hockey game. McClellan is essentially getting 5 minutes for spiritual high-sticking. Within a few weeks, he is set off on another mission with Parley P. Pratt. They end up back at home in Missouri as things begin to heat up and the Mormons are forced to leave. McClellan, apparently seeing the handwriting on the wall, opts to suddenly sell his land there. This is expressly frowned on and gets reported back to the headquarters in Kirtland. For this part, McClellan is strongly opposed to Joseph Smith's decision to bring in an armed group to Missouri, known as Zion's Camp, and he points to a revelation calling for the Mormons to renounce war and proclaim peace. When the group arrives, a council is held and David Whitmer is named president of the Missouri High Council. The position and powers he holds make it look like he is on roughly the same plane as Joseph Smith. And McClellan, really disenchanted with Joseph Smith after Zion's camp, felt that David Whitmer had been ordained as Smith's successor at this point.
So when we finally get to seriously talking about all the succession options when Joseph Smith dies, remember this one. David Whitmer is selected to oversee the church in Missouri. So now, despite everything that's happened, he's been excommunicated a couple times. McClellan is still appointed to be one of the original apostles in 1835. So again, excommunication, definitely not final. Multiple excommunications, definitely not final. Joseph Smith being angry at you for not locking your heart, not final. Now, later that year in 1835, what I consider the most ridiculous of all of McClellan's run-ins with Joseph Smith occurs. So his wife, Emmeline, writes him a letter informing him that she would probably not attend the adult school held in Kirtland. And McClellan responds, "It's probably a good idea. Orson Hyde has told him some stories. They're vague, that they don't paint the story in a good light." Joseph Smith gets wind of this letter, and since Sidney Rigdon is in charge of the school, this is clearly a slap in the face of the First Presidency. "You dare to challenge the authority of Sidney Rigdon?" I mean, seriously, it's culture of honor. They're 2 seconds away from slapping each other and challenging duels. So the result of this, they withdraw fellowship from McClellan and also Hyde. So Hyde gets thrown under the bus, too. But once again, this is very, you know, he's out of the penalty box 5 minutes later. And then the dedication of the Kirtland Temple occurs, and it's really this kind of one nice, quiet, peaceful interlude in McClellan's life.
After yet another missionary journey, McClellan returns to Kirtland and was apparently so disgusted by the robust land business that was being conducted, mostly by church leaders, that he writes an open letter to his colleagues in August of 1836 and withdraws. The apostles plead with him to return, and so he does. He comes back. He makes the move to Missouri, but it was never the same. In May of 1838, a court is held and Joseph Smith reported that McClellan, quote, "had no confidence in the heads of the church, believing they had transgressed, and had got out of the way. Consequently, he quit praying and keeping the commandments of God and indulged himself in his lustful desires. But when he heard that the First Presidency had made a general settlement and acknowledged their sins, he began to pray again," end quote. This, along with several stories during the conflict over the last few months in Missouri, depict a very menacing William McClellan. There are reports that he wanted to whip Joseph Smith while he was imprisoned, and that he raided Smith's house while he was gone, etc. Given the tendency to always throw dissenters under the bus, I take these accounts with some salt, not Sidney Rigdon's kind of salt. This was the final excommunication for McClellan, though, and he was done with Mormonism, this branch of Mormonism at least. And now we want to ask a question to a few historians, like amazing researcher Cheryl Bruno.
So, we've been talking about dissent, and like we pointed out, at every point, somebody stands up and is like, "Nope, not for me, I'm done." So what is it about Mormonism that leads so seamlessly to dissent?
Hi everyone, I'm Cheryl Bruno, coming to you from Seaside, California. I work part-time as a STEM instructor for Fused Learning, and by vocation, I'm a Mormon historian. My current field of interest is the intersection of Mormonism and Freemasonry in the 19th century. What are the elements of Mormonism that led so easily and seamlessly to dissent and schism? Well, I think that Joseph Smith laid the seeds for dissent and schism himself, and he did it two ways. First, he taught that it is the privilege of the children of God to come to God and get revelation. God is not a respecter of persons. We all have the same privilege. Since the 1830s, it's been taught that each individual member of the church can come to know of the divinity of the work. We can have the whisperings of the Spirit in our heart and soul. We can see visions, entertain angels, behold the face of the Lord, and receive all the knowledge and wisdom that has been poured out upon faithful people in any age. So starting from the very first days of the church, you have this tension between personal revelation and authority. What happens when you feel that you have a revelation from God and it goes against what your leader has felt has been revealed to him? Well, again, from the earliest days, you do exactly what Joseph Smith did. You found your own church. You do what Wycombe Clark did when he broke off in 1831 to found the Pure Church of Christ. You do what Warren Parrish did when he founded his Church of Christ. And so on. James Strang, William Godby, Denver Snuffer, etc. The second way Joseph Smith laid the foundation for schism was through two organizations that were formed in his final years in Nauvoo. In the Quorum of the Anointed, he made men and women kings and priests, queens and priestesses. When he gave them their second anointing, they received the fullness of the priesthood. In the Council of 50, an organization that was formed in the last months of his life, Joseph Smith sent many of these men out to form their own kingdoms. After he died, Brigham Young tried to rein many of these men in and have them follow him to the Great Basin. Men like Lyman White said, "No, Joseph Smith sent me to Texas to form my own kingdom." Alpheus Cutler, James Emmett, Peter Hawes, George Miller, George Day Adams, and Lucian Woodworth all felt that Brigham Young blocked their personal missions, which were given to them from Joseph Smith in the Council of 50. They felt that it was their responsibility to go forth and set up their own kingdoms, and they dissented from the church in order to do that. From that time until today, we still have that same impulse in the church. True, we have a strong emphasis on obedience to our leaders, but we're also taught to trust in our own revelations, to follow promptings no matter where they might lead us. We're taught to build kingdoms, and we're given the tools and the priesthood to do it.
One thing I do want to say, Brian, is that we forget that like a lot of the mobs were Mormons, former Mormons. I mean, people want to, the story I was told, it was like all these outsiders out to get Mormons, but they were people that had experience with and like had faith or trust in Joseph Smith at one time, correct?
Absolutely. If only we had some sort of organization that we could deal with dissenters. Not that we're, you know, spoiler alert or anything.
And just as a side note, if you go today to Temple Square during conference, some of the biggest protesters are people, you know, with the big evangelical signs or down at the Manti pageant. They're former Mormons and former Mormon fundamentalists, which tells you something. The rest of the world doesn't really care about Mormons. It's just those in and out that do.
So far, we've talked about people you've probably heard of. Next up, however, on the Bad Boy Countdown is somebody a little more exotic, Samson Avard. While you probably haven't heard about him specifically, you've definitely heard about his organization, the Danites.
Do you say Samson Avard or Avard? Because I always heard it was Samson Avard.
We need, like, you know how the Book of Mormon has a pronunciation guide? We could use one of those. Valate Kimball, for example. There was a very robust discussion on Facebook about this one, which cracked me up. Because, and Linda Newell, who wrote Emma Smith's biography, chimed in and was like, "No, it's Valate." But then somebody's like, "How do you know that?" She's like, "Well, I know descendants, and I'm Linda Newell. Back off." I sided with her. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, I should tell you that I absolutely had mail delivered to me under the name of Samson Avard in college. I regret nothing. Okay, Mr. Avard here. So he was a native of Britain, which at this point in Mormon history is pretty unique. Later on, I mean, obviously this would be almost expected, but not at this point. He was apparently baptized in Pennsylvania in 1835 by Orson Pratt, ordained an elder, and then left in charge of a branch. So early Mormonism, within 15 minutes of being baptized, you were either sent on a mission or a branch president. So quick learning curve. Lorenzo DeYoung, Brigham Young's younger brother, later said he met Avard during this period, and already he felt like some of his ideas were wonky. So Avard quickly is kind of, he keep an eye on him. And after that, Young said that Avard and Rigdon, Sidney Rigdon, were really good friends, and Avard had picked up some bad things from him. And there could be something to it. Samson Avard was apparently a minister in the Disciples of Christ movement before he gets to Mormonism, just like Sidney Rigdon. So, possibility.
So we need y'all to weigh in on the Facebook comments on the Sunstone page about Avard or Avard, because I'm going to let Brian call him Avard, and I'm going to go by something different.
The winner gets a Dr. Pepper, so there's a lot on this.
Okay, so back to Avard. Yada, yada. He starts the Danites. Cool, cool. By summer of 1838, the wheels were starting to come off a bit of the Mormon train. Having been kicked out of Ohio, Mormons were not doing any better in northern Missouri than they had done in Jackson County. The main difference between the two Missouri periods, this time internal dissent, basically just transplanted from Kirtland, was absolutely rampant. Joseph Smith was losing support from key figures left and right, apostles like Thomas Marsh and Orson Hyde, his most potent writer, W.W. Phelps, and the entire Whitmer family. And this time, Joseph Smith wasn't going to take it anymore. Summer got hot real quick. Sidney Rigdon preaches some straight fire sermons, the most infamous of which, the Salt Sermon, drew on the imagery of salt from the Sermon on the Mount, and he told dissenters to get the hell out and do not pass go, do not collect $200, and a shadowy organization with a truly bizarre name is created, quote, the Society of the Daughter of Zion. It then only seemed fair that the name taken from the Book of Micah hints at a dark mission statement, quote, arise and thresh, O daughter of Zion, for I will make thine horn iron, and I will make thy hoofs brass, and thou shalt beat in pieces many people, and I will consecrate their gain unto the Lord, and their substances unto the Lord of the whole earth. I feel like I need to read that one more time, but with like scary music. At some point, the group becomes better known as, dun-dun-dun, the Danites, i.e. the tribe of Dan in the Old Testament. Guess who the most famous Danite dude in the Bible is? The original mullet himself, Samson. Remember, we're spotlighting Samson Avard. Coincidence? Now, later historians would try to distance Joseph Smith from the organization. While he doesn't seem to have been a super active participant, it's worth remembering that he was, you know, the leader of church, and he certainly benefited from their protections. Even his journal ominously notes, quote, we have a company of Danites in these times to put to rights physically that which is not right, and to cleanse the church of very great evils which hath hitherto existed among us, insomuch as they cannot be put to rights by teachings and persuasions, end quote. The group took on sort of Masonic elements, like tokens, passwords, and a sign of distress, which is the right palm of your face with your ear in between your thumb and forefinger. Oh, you just like cover your ear. Signs are weird. Okay. I feel like they could have come up with like the floss or something cooler. However, within a few months, Avard is captured, and so is Joseph Smith, and Mormons are booted out of another state. Avard would spill the beans on the scope of Mormon retaliation efforts and was excommunicated in early 1839.
All right, you can't have bad boys of early Mormonism unless we do bad girls of early Mormonism, right? That's up next. Now for today's Books of Mormon report, Differing Visions. So obviously we've highlighted some dissenters here. Not surprising, there's lots more. Great book published by the University of Illinois Press, and it talks about all sorts of different folks. Mike Quinn, Joseph Musser. So lots of interesting folks from the whole scope of Mormonism, beginning to end, and different branches of the Mormon umbrella. So very highly recommended.
As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com. And consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.